Post Harlan Mono Logics. Number 00031. Recorded on March 21, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Chapter 31.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised. Trigger warning. This series deals with topics that may be disturbing. Subject matter may include domestic violence, sexual abuse, and subsequent mental health disorders. If you are sensitive to such material, consider entertainment alternatives.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
We are going from woke up this morning and got myself a gun, the Alabama 3 song, to Janie's Got a Gun, the Aerosmith song, the late 80s on the Pump LP. If you do not know that song by some chance, here's where you're trigger warning comes into play. If you are sensitive to issues involving child abuse, molestation, incest, pedophilia, if you are sensitive to issues related to those things, and by that I mean behaviors of your own that are the unfortunate sequence and result of having had been abused, what is to come here in this episode may be a little more than you can bear emotionally and psychically. You have been warned. So as I was saying, in the late 80s, Aerosmith got clean, got sober, got together, got their shit in order, and made what may be their best album, called Pump. And on that album, they had a song with a video called Janie's Got a Gun. Janie's Got a Gun is about the retribution / self-defense of a girl who was being molested by her father or stepfather, some father figure in her life, and shot the motherfucker dead. I don't know that it's a true story. I'm sure this sort of thing has happened many, many times. The inspiration for this ballad, these lyrics, I don't know if it's true. I don't know if it's something that Steven Tyler or Joe Perry or anybody else in the band maybe read about in a newspaper article. I don't know. What I do know is that it's very clear what it's about. What I do know, some of the lyrics say things like, the man has got to be insane. Once upon a time in this world, it was right and normal to look at the misbehavior of people, of adult men, on the female children, girls, and say, that motherfucker is crazy. That is wrongful. That is degenerate. But of course, somewhere since then, somebody wanted to turn around and quote-unquote normalize it. Aerosmith could not write that song today and put it out and not expect to have petitioners up and down their fucking streets in front of their little mansions. Times have changed. But back then, in my generation, you would speak up loudly and vocally in defense of the innocent. And hold the guilty to the standard of fucking death. This song was a video. And the video played on MTV. Oh, not today. But back then it did. I know that the lyrics talk about the fact that that scumbag father figure has got to be insane. Insane. Because back then it was. It was insanity. To rape somebody. To rape a child. To abuse a child in any way. To abuse a person of any age or gender in any way. All insanity. Somebody decided to change that and make it normal. Now the victim is the person that can't help but do that shit to other people. And the world is duly fucked up. But back then, Aerosmith, one of the most famous bands in the entire world, could boldly stand up and say that. And MTV can play the video around the clock. Some of the lyrics say someone had to stop the threat, right? The threat. It wasn't a one-off thing that this fucking scumbag did. It was something he was doing routinely. And Janie, the girl, gets a gun. Janie, the girl with the gun, shoots that scumbag dead in the fucking head. And it ain't even murder. Why? Because he was in a serial manner, continually doing this, meaning he would do it again. His crime was ongoing. Therefore, her shooting him stopped a crime in progress, as far as I'm fucking concerned. If it was a one-off thing, that really sucks and it's really bad. But there's ways to handle that that don't require murdering the guy, and I will get into that. But because it was a sequence of events, it was almost guaranteed that the scumbag would do it again. In my book, the girl is right. The girl should be walking the fucking streets. But you're going to need a lot of help. Because that kind of behavior leaves a mark on a soul and a psyche. Someone had to stop the threat. Now, apart from the lyrical and thematic content of this song, which is really deep, musically superior and very unique guitar work. Incredible. It could have spawned off its own genre of music. That good. That good. What a very well constructed song in general. What an excellent ballad with excellent lyrics that told a very meaningful and important story. Of course, most obviously, sung, vocalized by one of the greatest, most talented vocalists in the history of rock and roll music. Whatever you think of Steven Tyler, you cannot say he's not great at what he does. A perfect song, top to bottom. It doesn't just rock, it rocks your fucking world. What I mean to say, even for me, I don't know why, that song brings me to tears. I don't know why. There is a certain passion in me. Friends of mine, compadres throughout my life have recognized me to be somewhat of a passionate person, right? Generally, I'm passionate about whatever is interesting me at the moment. I have a way of kind of getting obsessed with the interest du jour, right? Though I am passionate in that regard, that is not my passion. People close to me, my compadres through my life, they understand that I have a particular degree of underlying rage in me. It's always been that way. I've been known, not just for my passion, but for my wrath, for my anger. These are not things I'm proud of, all right? I'm expressing who I am in the eyes of others. And, of course, looking in the mirror, I can do nothing but fully concur. These things are real. I have a passion and I have a rage. But it's not what you might expect. The source of it is not what you expect. What moves me in these ways is not what you would expect. I have in me, and it's most likely the greatest part of me. After all the destruction of everything and all the failure in my life, the simple vestiges of a crumbling monolith that holds me up structurally is this nature I have as defender of the innocent. Defender of the innocent. I cannot stand to see innocence violated. I'm the kind of guy that if I caught a parent mistreating their own child in a supermarket, that parent's getting the what for and might get the beat down and may even get killed. Depending on the seriousness of the situation. But I cannot stand there and watch that, and nor can I walk away from it. It will be dealt with. And I cannot help myself. I have to do that. And I know in this rotten fucking world that is made up of that behavior. What I mean to say, the exponential growth of wicked on this earth begins with abuse. And that abuse is carried forward. The abused becomes the abuser, and so on, and so on, and so on, exponentially. The evil of this world, the wicked of this world, is spread in that regard. It's how it's done. How do you stop it? The truth is, you've got to stop it in your own self. And if every fucking body done that, we would have something just south of paradise. But it ain't gonna happen. It requires a whole hell of a lot. You gotta give up a hell of a lot. So short of that, Janie's got a gun and put a bullet in his brain. And at least that stopped one avenue of abuse. But now Janie's all fucked up. And God knows what Janie's gonna do. There's all kinds of variants that come out of the result of having had been violated. Does bad shit happen in this world? Bet your ass it happens in this world. Not all of it is broadcast. Most of it is not. And I'll get into some of that. But I'll tell you one story that you never heard. And it's the greatest thing, bar none, that I ever did in my entire fucking life. Nothing before it mattered and nothing since it mattered. The one greatest moment, the one greatest act I ever did. I was only 7 years old. Listen to this. I'm in second grade. My brother's in the first. We lived in a city right next to Newark called Hillside, New Jersey. We had just moved 2-3 years earlier out of Newark. Well, actually out of another part of Hillside. We were at Newark prior to that. One fine day, it was a spring day. My brother and I are walking home from school, Calvin Coolidge School. We only had to walk like 2 blocks to get home. Generation X children that we were going home to an empty house because mom had to work. On the way to the empty house, we were walking along with 2 other kids from the block. One named Mark, one named Anthony. Anthony was our neighbor, an Italian kid. We had a stormy relationship, but that's another story. We were best friends and best enemies, that kind of thing. Boys will be boys, right? What we were doing on the way home was playing some kind of... let's just call it mean-spirited game of tag. Our friend Mark was a little bit on the slow side, right? A little bit slow. Not sure that he was exactly retarded, but he was a little on the slow side, a little goofy, and assholes that we were, we picked on him a little bit. But we were still his friends. We would go hang out with him and, you know, play and shit like that. But then sometimes we'd have these moments where we kind of just picked on him. So our game of tag, see, tag, when you played tag back then, I don't know what kids do now, but, it's, you know, they probably do it online. I laugh. None of this is going to be funny. You just stick with it, right? Well, playing tag was simply somebody is, quote unquote, it, right? It's like you've got the cooties or whatever, the power, however you want to look at it, but you got to get rid of it and give it to somebody else. And all that requires is you go and touch somebody, right? When you're it, you got to go touch somebody, and then they become it. So we played this when we were a kid. when we were kids, and he did it all the time. It was just a stupid game that you had 5 minutes to burn. All right, let's play tag. All right, yay. And everybody starts scattering, and whoever it is, go run after somebody. And you usually would go, it's like animals, the fucking lions on the Serengeti with the hyena and the wildebeest. You go for the weakest in the pack, right? The easiest to get. Mark, being a little slow-witted, was usually the easiest to get. So we've got a four-way game of tag going, right? I'm it. I'll tag Mark. Mark is going to have a hard time getting anybody, and he'll remain it. But if he gets somebody, they're going to turn around and get Mark again. And that's what we were doing. We just continually would make Mark it. I wouldn't tag Anthony. I wouldn't tag my brother. But I would tag Mark. And if Mark tagged one of them, they would tag him back. And it just went like that. It was kind of mean-spirited in that regard, you know. We were collectively ganging up on him. I mean, we weren't punching him or throwing rocks at him. We weren't hurting him. But we were taking advantage of his weakness, right? And to me, it was mean. And I felt guilty. And that's why I say all this. The guilt mattered. I felt guilty about what we were doing to this boy, right? He was happy as a clown. Because we were playing with him. It didn't matter. He didn't know. He was slow, but he didn't know. We were playing. He was laughing and smiling, but I felt guilty like we were picking on him. We turn a corner onto our street. Now, Mark, he goes straight because he lived the next block up. He goes straight, so it's just me, Anthony, and my brother. And we're going up the block. We get like one driveway up, right? And all of a sudden, this big black Cadillac comes around the corner, slams on the brakes, door swings open, and this big hippie-looking, he wasn't a hippie. He had long hair and a long beard, and he was like 8 foot tall. The big, enormous fucking dude, right? Hey, you kids! And I immediately thought, oh my God, this must be like Mark's fucking uncle or something. And he caught us doing what we were doing. So, I scattered. I just fucked it. I'm gone. Psst, let's get the fuck out of here. Whoop! Down the street. So, me and Anthony, being the older two, we were gone. Younger brother, my brother, he wasn't putting two and two together. He stood there for a minute and that big guy grabbed him. Right? That big guy grabbed him. And he's trying to shove him, my brother, into this Cadillac. And my brother is doing like cats do if you try to shove it in a toilet or something like that. Try to shove it in a bed. The arms go out, the legs go out. You just can't push that fucker in. He was doing that shit. And the guy would grab him and hold him way up in the air. And it's like he visibly pissed his pants. He was in terror. He was in fucking horror. But meanwhile, me and Anthony, We're like 3-4 houses down the street. We're gone. And I will run straight the fuck to Newark before I'm stopping and getting picked up by this Cadillac motherfucker, right? It was two of them, right? The one driver and the one got out the passenger, this big guy with the long hair and the beard. Anthony, he starts hitting me. He's like, dude, he's mugging your brother, man. He's mugging your brother. And of course, me, I'm the second. I don't know what mugging is. The Italian kid knows, right? From all the mob movies and shit. His older siblings or whatever. I didn't know what mugging was. I didn't care. And he's no, they're mugging your brother. And I stopped and I looked and I saw what was going on. And I see my brother like 8 feet up in the air with piss running down his jeans and he's wailing and turning red and this guy now he's turning. He's trying to shove him into the fucking Cadillac. And I don't know what's going on, but this got to stop. And I did what I could do, you know. I didn't run no more. I was running, and I wasn't thinking about nobody else but myself. But when I saw my innocent little brother, something was happening to him, and I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what these fuckers were doing. I didn't know what the outcome of it was going to be. And so you get older, you learn what this shit was going to be, right? At least a potential. So I did the only thing I knew to do. And I kicked a chunk of the broken curb. And some little chips of cement, concrete, flecked off. And I grabbed these pebbles and these stones and I just started chucking them. And I went from small to big. I'm throwing, I'm trying to hit this guy. I don't know what the fuck to do. And he's trying to shove my brother into the car. And I'm throwing stones. They're bouncing off the hood of the big old Cadillac. Cadillacs were like 3 blocks long back then, right? It was one of those. It was like an early 70s, late 60s Cadillac. 4-door, the fucking thing was humongous. And I'm dropping rocks on the hood. And Anthony's dropping rocks on the hood. And, you know, the Italian kid. And we're missing this dude. You know, every once in a while, you hit him with a little stone. And it just got to the point where I ran out of shit. All there was this the hunk of fucking jagged concrete that was like twice the size of my hand. And I ran up as close as I could get to that motherfucker. And I threw that thing with everything I had. And I hit him square in the fucking face, man. Right in the fucking face. And his face busted open with blood spurting out. And he let go of my brother. And with his pissy little pants. And we all three ran down the fucking street for our lives. And that fucking Cadillac took off. Tires screaming, squealing. And all these fucking neighbors now starting to look out on the porch and shit. We had all these old people in the neighborhood and everything. And it was a real scene. And we ran to the Italian kid's house because his mother was home, and they called the cops, they ordered pizza for us, calmed us all the fuck down, and my mother to come home to it. You know, she found out when she got home from work what had happened, of course mortified. That was it. That was my life right there. I did what I could do to defend the innocent. And the results of it speak for itself. My life don't matter. It don't mean shit. And I've not really accomplished much of anything. And I've never spawned off the next generations. Or it all stops at down my road. But my brother, on the other hand, he got married. And he had kids. And those kids are in their 20s now. And they're college graduates. And they're beautiful. And they're smart. And they're going to have kids. And life goes on. Because I did one meaningful thing in my stupid life, right? And it's been all nonsense ever since. Because this defender of the innocent in me, and even as a kid, as a fucking child, that stood up like a courageous man and did what it knows to do. You know, some 8, 9, 10 years later, in a conversation with my mother, in this upper middle class suburban subdevelopment community that I ended up growing up in, which to me is ridiculous. We were never that kind of family, but there we go, right? She told me that she had this real scumbag stalking her. And I knew who the scumbag was. I had actually smoked weed with him a time or two. In our neighborhood, we had this psychotic dude. He was one of the basement dweller types, but he was psychotic, and he was like really violently dangerous. He had a reputation. I knew he was an abuser of narcotics, you know. He was probably 2-3 times my weight. I was a big kid, right? I was a big kid. I was damn near the size I am right now as I speak to you. I was maybe an inch shorter and maybe 10-15 pounds lighter. But I was a big kid. And, yeah, she told me, or I overheard. I don't know exactly how that went, but there were some details of several instances of this psycho of the neighborhood stalking her in the community at the pool, in her driveway, up in our little town village. It's various places this guy kept on turning up, like he was evidently stalking her. And a defender of the innocent that I am, when called upon, I went into a fucking rage. And my mother couldn't hold me down, and nobody can hold me down. And I went over. The guy lived behind us and down at the corner. I knew exactly where he lived. In his parents' house with his parents. A real creep, a real scumbag, a psycho. A violent person with drug problems. Who could never put his own life together. People were afraid of that fucking dude. I was not that day. I marched right up to the front door of that house and I started pounding on that fucking door. And I was gonna fucking kill him. His mother answered the door, little old lady. And she knew I was gonna kill him. I told her why I was there. And she was very concerned. But she did everything to run cover for that guy. And for the rest of the time I lived in that neighborhood, I couldn't find that dude. I don't know if that family sent him off somewhere, knowing that the stalker was now being stalked. Because I didn't give up. I was going to find him and I was going to kill him. My mother had stalkers. My mother apparently was a beautiful blonde woman, right? Blonde hair, blue eye. I never saw her in that light. I'm her son and I'm not sick in that regard, right? And I'm sorry if you are. Sickness is sickness. I don't care how culture wants to redefine and normalize things, all right? I never saw my mother in that light, but my buddies, my friends around the neighborhood, people who knew her, always talked about how gorgeous, how striking my mother was, and that always made me a little, you know? But I looked at who was saying it, and I saw the context that they were using it, and it never really was a problem. But this one fucking psycho scumbag was a problem, and I was going to kill him. These are two examples. People fuck, specifically with my family, but it doesn't mean that it's just about family with me. In fact, it is not. I am defender of the innocent. Anybody innocent in any situation. You could be guilty 5 times in a row and shit, but if you're standing in a situation now, a new scene, and you're the innocent one, I will defend you. I am a defender of the innocent, and I can't help it. I cannot help it. That is what my passion is, and that is what my rage is. That is what pisses me off. I do not like to see violation of people in this world. So I speak in this podcast, and you can hear the agitation I have over simple things like people throwing trash on the ground or not flushing the fucking toilet after they're done using it, you know, leaving turds or logs floating around. And In my way of looking at things, that's a violation. I'm thinking not of me. Yes, if I really think it through, obviously it's disrespect for me because they know I'm the person that's got to clean that shit up, right? But before my mind goes there, I just think in general terms of whoever the next person is now violated. If you walk into a bathroom and you're in a hurry and you got to take a shit, got diarrhea or something, right? You run to the stall, you open it up, you go, and it's all full of fucking turd and paper and tissues. It's all jammed up. Do you have that 2 minutes it's going to take to clean that shit up? Are you going to be fortunate that any of the other stalls are not occupied? Are you going to end up shitting your pants and this is where my mind goes. It is a violation. Somebody's being violated, and that's like the honeypot of violation. You have some kind of trash somewhere on the ground. You know, I gave an example. I might have said it in a previous episode where a guy that works here walked into the restroom, the men's room, hocked a loogie from deep down in the depths of his fucking disgustingness, and just bleh, into the fucking a little garbage pail, right? Yeah, just whatever was in that person now is just this gob of disgust laying on the top of everything that's in that trash can. And what is it? So say this guy's got COVID. Say this guy's got the flu. Say this guy's got some fucking STD. Whatever. Some contagion. He just made a little honeypot for everybody who goes walking in and out that door of those germs just wafting up. Wafting up. And if he's not contagious with anything, then it comes to me, the fucking maid that's got to go turn that trash pail over at some point every day. And now is that shit going to drip onto me? You know what I'm saying? You don't need that in your life. Now, I'm violated, but somebody's being violated. So when I speak of these things and I have the tone that I have, this is exactly where it's coming from. The defender of the innocent inside of me is an angry person. There is a righteous indignation that is resident very near to the core of my being. And I've been fighting with my anger and wrath for a very long time. And I got to a point with it where it just doesn't seem to end. I cannot diminish it any further. Whatever is remaining must remain. It is meant to remain. It is a necessary and required part of me that makes me who I am. I'm not trying to justify it. If it would go away, it would go away. I'm not holding on to it. I'm not white knuckling it and clawing it to fucking death, right? But I'm a defender of the innocent, and like, that is my rage. That is my passion. Why, like I say, a song like Janie's Got a Gun and what its lyrical content is speaking to, why does that song bring me to tears, right? I talk about being a defender of the innocent. I'm not the one being violated. I'm the one protecting the potential of those who are about to be violated, right? I'm a protector. Why do I cry over it? I would never call myself the most sympathetic or most empathetic person in the world. That is something else I've had to work on in my life. You know, I have a INTJ temperament type. That is the Spock temperament. I am basically Vulcan in terms of empathy and sympathy. I've had to really try to put myself in other people's shoes. And I still, that's not a past tense. I still have to. If I am going to achieve any degree of empathy, I have to really work at it. It's a failing, but it's a temperament. So why would a song that's talking about the abuse of somebody innocent trigger me, right? I talked about a trigger warning. Why would I be triggered by that? I would think that that would piss me off before it made me cry. But it makes me tear up. It always has. I don't know why. I don't know why. You know, this monologue in the first part, it spoke to high school burnouts, right? The idea that once a burnout, always a burnout. I'm not even sure exactly what that means, but I know it's true. You know, the evidence in me is I'm still a burnout, and I haven't done drugs or anything, or even drank in more than 34 years, right? I mentioned that earlier. I mention that all the time. That's a big, important part of my life. What I say, what I do, my worldview, my logic structure, everything is clean and sober. You listen to me. I'm not on drugs. I do the things I do. There's no drugs or liquor involved with it. I have endured reality uninterrupted all these fucking years, right? So once a burnout, always a burnout. What a burnout is, I talked about that. It was the freaks of the time is what it comes down to, right? We were the freaks of that day. We were literally called the freaks. We were literally calling ourselves a freak. Oh, he's a freak. Yeah, she's a freak. And it was a good thing. It's really not. It's really not a good thing. But to us, it was. It was a matter of camaraderie and pride. That's who we were in the social structure. That's where we panned out. And, you know, what I didn't realize about that freakism. Like, see, in my life, I, at that age, was really what they called acting out. I had behavioral issues. There was something disturbing me, right? Disturbing me. And I never have come to know what that was. Let me start over again. This is not easy to talk about. It's not easy to talk about something that you just don't know, you know? And that's the whole point I'm trying to make. I had displayed every indication of a very problemed adolescent, right? It was evident in every outward way that something very traumatic had happened in my little world at some point in time. But I had no awareness of it. I still don't. It's been the big question mark and mystery of my entire existence, next to the seeking of truth of Jesus Christ, right? You know, the problem within me. Why did I go down the road that I went down when prior to that everything seemed so promising, you know? Why did I take this massive left turn and go straight through the gates of hell like I did? Why? Why did that happen? What triggered me? What is my sensitivity? What the fuck happened? I had every evidence of it. There was no adult, no authority figure, no cohort or compadre. Nobody who fucking knew me could deny that there was something really wrong with me. But I didn't know what it was, and nobody could tell me. And we smoked a lot of pot, we drank a lot of beer, and we had the ability to open up and talk about just about anything in the universe. And I don't really recall having a whole lot of conversations involving some of the tragic and traumatic things that happen, like in the song Janie's Got a Gun, for example, right? But it turns out, and I learned this through a conversation with one of my cohorts and compadres, a woman who's now a Texan, right? We grew up and went to high school in New Jersey. She lives down in Austin. We were having some conversations when I last moved back to Texas. Met up through social media, because that's the standard of the times. And yeah, we had some really great long conversations about the old days and, you know, the problems she's currently, well, at that time, whatever was current, enduring, which involved some degenerate behavior, right? Trying not to lay too many fucking tracks and leave too much popcorn behind. But because she was going through stuff. The topic of stuff was always readily at hand. She's a very intelligent person, and we've always had very intelligent conversations that had the capability at any given time of spanning anything, right? Anything. And so we got into talking about a whole bunch of this kind of very sensitive, quote-unquote, trigger warning type of material. And from her perspective, with her personality and whatnot, she had learned directly from so many of our friends, our burnouts, or quote-unquote burnouts in the school, that just about every single one of us had some kind of past trauma that involved abuse, you know, violence or molestation or rape or pedophilia or some of the above, all the above. Incest, all these things, right? All these things. And our reaction, right, collectively, right, as young people, was a turning to drugs. That was the common bond we had. That's why we were called burnouts, right? We were the freaks of the day, but the freak thing to do was destroy yourself on drugs to find some kind of solace in narcotics. We all felt a great need to go that direction. We all have different stories, and a lot of those stories weren't generally told publicly. Again, because at that time, such things were shameful. After the grunge era, it started to be brought out into the light. And I get a feeling nowadays it's starting to get shoved back in the fucking closet again. Because the scumbags who do this shit rule the world. That's another story, and that will be told. But anyway, what I'm saying now is, in my high school, our population of burnouts, by and large, unbeknownst to me, in the same manner that even my own issues are unbeknownst to me, right, had issues. Had these kinds of issues, male and female, not just the girls. You'd expect it with the girls for some reason, but no. Guys had issues too. Some of us, obviously, like me, don't even know what they were. Something happened. Something happened somewhere. And I don't know what it is. I've always tried to look, right? My approach to it, you know, my reckoning, my best ability based on what is obviously incomplete data, something is missing in my memory, in my mind. The best I could do is kind of put it together in a manner of like Pink Floyd the Wall, right? Roger Waters wrote about ultimately coming unglued, but the process was a kind of piece by piece, step by step thing. Another brick in the wall. Some event happened that impacted him in a certain way, and boom, there's a brick. And then something else happened, boom, there's another brick. And this wall gets built up, right? So in that manner, I could look at it sort of like just a stacking up of things, events and occurrences and situations. And then it finally became, to use another analogy, the final straw that broke the camel's back, right? You could keep on heaping weight onto somebody, and they can carry it, and they're strong enough, and all of a sudden there's just this little tiny, little light thing that just crosses the line of a person's capability, and they're crushed under it. So, you know, that's my findings. When I just search my own soul to try to understand why I just came completely unglued at the age of 13 like I did. That's my best reckoning. It just must have been a matter of the last straw doing me in. And because that's what I come to through process of logical deduction does not make it the truth. It's just the best I can do. But it really does not speak to the rage that I had, right? Going back to the anger before, my expression of anger in my life is actually something that is necessary for me to be who I am to a point. Now, there was anger in excess, right? As I talk about instincts gone awry. But if my anger ultimately is based on something to do with the violation of innocence, and then I was a very angry kid lashing out at all authority, you can start to see like where the math is forming up, the equations, the formulations are starting to come into place, and the surrounding an invisible entity, starting to drape it in evidence, suggesting somebody done something. And I draw a blank. I don't know what that something is or was, you know. This is hard stuff. This is very very difficult. It's very difficult to say, and I'm sure it's very difficult to hear. That's why I gave a trigger warning. That's fair, is it not fair? So, you know, I have never known the root cause that has driven my rage and my passion. So once upon a time, something happened. Something unknown. Something seemingly supernatural. Something perhaps super unknown. What do I mean by that? Super unknown is LP, released in 1994, only a month or two before Kurt Cobain's suicide, by the very well-known, very popular grunge band Soundgarden. And it was probably the height of their creative ability and success. Great, great album. I listened to the songs off of that thing every day for, it seemed, a couple of years during that time, right? I had it fairly hot off the presses. A lot of songs, a lot of airplay. Very popular album, very well known, super unknown. And then one of the songs on it's called Super Unknown, right? Now, when I recognize the fact that Soundgarden, a grunge band, has a song called Super Unknown, and I go through the lyrics as the song plays, I kind of get the idea that we're dealing with the struggle between the punk ethos and the commercial success. And I believe as they were creating this particular record, they were out on the threshold, right? They were on the threshold about to move in. They were known, they were well known, but they were about to become world sensation. And I think they knew it was coming. I believe this song harkens to that. I believe this song is, and I don't know what the story, the backstory to the song is and what the intent of the lyrics are. It's just the sense that I get listening to it and reckoning the lyrics, it's that concern that the grunge people had about fame and success, and it's tied to the long-standing history in rock and roll music about the crossroads. As I mentioned before, as I mentioned through these monologues multiple times, right? The crossroads, the story itself, is mythological. I mean, can there be absolute truth about what happened with Robert Johnson on the Delta in Mississippi back in the 20s? Could it be that he actually met up with the devil and had his strings tuned up and sold his soul? It could be like that. It could be. There's no telling how the devil operates, you know, specifically. It's also very possible that it's kind of mythological, an idea, right? Folklore. And that folklore moves forward through all kinds of entertainment people and anybody really who would pursue fame, right? Fame is owned by the devil. You, if you are a Christian and you know your Bible, recognize this. When Jesus was tempted by Satan after 40 days of fasting in the wilderness, right? That one of the temptations ultimately, the greatest temptation is the offer of the world. You know, anything you see before you, you can have if only you bow down before me, right? And that is the deal that these street punks with guitars get from record executives, right? And then they got what they call quote unquote sell out. And I believe that Super Unknown, as a song lyrically, is speaking to that. And I believe that every grunge band has at least one song that's addressing this consideration, probably multiple songs. They're singing about their lives. They're singing about the industry. They're singing about the world that they live in when they're singing about the crossroads and when they're singing about the record executives, when they're singing about busting out and being owned. You know, and you don't have to be punkish. You don't have to have a punk ethos. Lynyrd Skynyrd had a problem working for MCA. You know, they did what they did, and then all of a sudden they're signed on to this big record label, and then all of a sudden people are telling them how to do shit, when to do shit, why to do shit. What the fuck, man? We were doing shit before we met you, but that's how it goes. You know, they get their artistic license trampled on, shoved into a fucking trash can. And no artistic person wants their artistic freedom tampered with, right? So I believe that's what the song is about. However, taking the title, as I relate it to an unknown something that happens in the lives of we people who ultimately exhibit fucked up in this, right? Like me, right? Like me. Something traumatic happened somewhere along the way, and I'm amongst the people that don't know what that is. You know, something happened when I was too young, or something happened when I had that I had a mental block over, and I don't have an awareness of it. So it's unknown to me, right? And I can easily, as a Christian, reckon that as a demonic entity and an insertion into my psyche, right? I've been talking about the damaged psyche all through this monologue so far. But is it really a damaged psyche? Or is it an invaded psyche? Interesting to contemplate. The album cover, the art, right, for Super Unknown, has this demonic image on the front of it. It's this orange, red, blurry face that looks like it has pointed ears or horns or some shit. And you don't know what the hell it is, but it absolutely looks demonic. It looks like something that you'd catch out of the corner of your eye as a demon was running by, right? And so there's some demonic element to whatever Soundgarden Super Unknown is. And what I'm saying here is I can easily pose the wicked and demonic and that word Super Unknown onto the experience that I have in my life with some kind of mystery, something or another, causing me to be triggered by whatever, whenever, and basically just fucking up my whole life, right? In the song lyrics of Super Unknown, basically there's a short little chorus. First it steals your mind, and then it steals your first it steals your mind, and then it steals your soul, ultimately, is the word, right? It steals your mind. It steals your soul. The cover is demonic. It's super unknown. all this shit just adds up to me and just falls neatly into place, right? But I do recognize what those young men were going through at the time with their entry into fame and the uncertainty about it, and seeing that as the devil reaching his hand out with a contract, right? So my theme is, at this moment, the unnatural behavior that we somehow come to in our lives, and the hidden origins that generate that, right? The hidden origins of unnatural behavior. And I've got a couple of examples quickly at mind. A couple of them pertain directly to me. I'm speaking from experience here, right? When I was young, when I was younger, I had suicidal ideation, suicidal fantasy, suicidal attempts. And it was like a constant in my pattern of thinking. I wasn't going more than a couple of minutes. You know, I would have to be busy, wrapped up in something interesting, some kind of task at hand that required the full on of my mentality in order not to have my mind drifting back into the romanticizing of my fucking death, all right? And that's how dark and black I was in my life earlier on. And that is not a natural behavior. That is not a natural way of thinking. That is not a natural way of life. To be suicidal is contrary. And I hope you recognize this, okay? We have the most basic instinct that we have in us is that one to survive. We do not want to die. And everything about us, when everything is functioning naturally and normally, drives us into the way to survive whatever situation we have stumbled into, right? But now you got this teenager who is just riddled with thoughts of suicide and romancing his own death. And isn't that the most unnatural and saddest fucking thing, right? There's an unnatural quality to that person's existence. And where did that come from? Where did the mind get distorted? Where did the quote-unquote normalcy fly out the fucking window? When did this young person's natural humanity get torn to shreds and thrown to the fucking wind? I say it's a matter of hidden origins. Super unknown. A demonic insertion. I expect eventually we'll get into sin. S-I-N, right? Sin. For now, what I want to say about that is that we are born innocent into a world that is completely riddled with sin. It is completely riddled with evil and wicked at every turn. And when we are born into this world, it is not long before the wicked hand reaches into our existence somehow, some way. We are touched by sin in somebody. And when that sin comes to us, we process it in some way. And I don't know. That's as mysterious as anything else. Different for every situation, for every person, for every assault. I don't know exactly how that goes and exactly how that works, but our innocence gets lost and sin becomes a part of us. And it's really variable in the degree of, you know, from person to person, how they're affected. What sin comes to a person, right? There's some more damaging and damning type of behaviors that people do to one another. And when you're a little baby, your mind is really just starting to put two and two together a little bit, you know? You can almost talk, you know, some words and shit. And then something happens to you. It's like the big slap in the face. You know, it's like you come into this world and the doctor slaps you good and gets your fucking heart going and lungs breathing. But then you get this other slap where sin enters into you. Kids who have an environment that's conducive to immorality are going to be subjected to all kinds of shit that other kids in a healthy household will not be subjected to. And this is the difference in people as we go along, right? I say the sin that confronts us early on in our lives ends up being triggered later on. When the time is right. When the time is right for whatever demon or demons, plural, have come into your realm, your personal realm. You know, innocence is lost. I have recall of it was a guided meditation. And I would have been in my 30s, about mid-30s at the time, early to mid-30s. I'd say mid-30s, probably about right. 34, 35, somewhere around there. A guided meditation left me with a vision of myself as a baby in a bassinet, left alone out in the middle of a meadow in Branch Brook Park in Newark. That's it. The vision was this bassinet out in the field, nobody around it. And the vision was just like drawing nearer and nearer to the bassinet to look inside that bassinet. And what I saw was like the most noble, honorable being. It was like a baby king. And it was me. And it's you, and it's the person next to you. It's all of us. See, that is the innocence that we were born with. We were holy beings from the get-go. But the sin of the world inserted itself into each and every single fucking one of us. But in a variance, in a varied degree of oppression and distortion. Of pain, of damage, of trauma. And as we would go through life, that assault becomes a continual thing because it's everywhere in the world all the time. The demons mount up on us. So this is a very spiritual look at this psychic trauma that I've been speaking to thus far, right? The hidden origins, right? They could be psychic damage, they could be a demonic insertion, they could be both. But I believe they are. I believe every one of us has hidden damage done. Some of us have this traumatic damage that is done, that is hidden, that really, when it's triggered, it comes out in a big fucking way. Obvious way. For everybody else, it's more subtle. You know, what's subtle? Another thing personal to me, right? Obviously, I mention it all the time. It's a big part of my life, right? The alcohol and drug abuse, right? that was a big part of my life when I was young, and then the recovery from that has been a central part of my being ever since. There is no life if I don't have this recovery in focus continually, right? But that alcohol and drug abuse, it is literally abuse. When you say alcohol and drug abuse, are you abusing the alcohol and you abusing the drugs? No, those are abusing you. You are being abused by that shit in the same manner that whatever evil befell you and greeted you so cordially into the world of sin. That was such a great imagery right there. We abuse ourselves in that same exact regard when we take drugs. Therefore, just like suicidal ideation, in fact, it is in some way suicidal ideation. You're literally abusing yourself, and it's to the point where you'll kill yourself. All of this is working against your very basic survival instinct. Something is twisted in you. Something is twisted in me to do that, to go into alcohol and drug abuse. Use? I think all use is abuse. I really do. You know, the Bible tells me to be, what is it? Sober of mind and clear conscience, like as a way of being. And the blessed fortune of the failures I had with alcohol and drug abuse is that it led me to recovery. And then by default, forever on, I have clear conscience and sober judgment, you know? It's a hard way to live. I'm very different than most people out there. I don't get to have a glass of wine with dinner. I don't get to have that occasional toke or two off the bone to take the edge off. You know, that's not harming anybody. That's not doing any damage. But you know what? When you're a drug abuser, when you're an addict, you can't do that shit because it'll just set it all off again. And you'll go right back down the toilet. So I say that because it gives you a little perspective. I mean, imagine going through everything that you go through day in and day out, hour after hour, all the bullshit in life, and really having nowhere to run away to. Imagine your wife cheating on you and breaking your fucking heart, destroying your entire world. And you can't turn to whiskey to get you through some of the roughest points. Imagine that. Imagine the fortitude that it takes, right? And this is what somebody who's sober has to deal with. It's how we have to live. Every shitty thing that comes along in the world, we have to address with sobriety. And everything we do returns to us the guilt due for us to process. That's where the clear conscience comes into it. There's no running away and hiding. Right? Led Zeppelin has a song, Living, Loving, Made. When your conscience hits you, knock it back with pills. That's a way to stay immoral, demonic, evil. You knock it back with pills. That's where drugs come into the game. Big part of it, you never have to address the guilt that your conscience is laying on you. That conscience is God inside of you, talking to you. Just in the same manner that you've been invaded by these demons. And here is the outgrowth of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's where the knowledge comes from. Get it? Right? Get it? It's like the cartoons. You get the angel on one shoulder and you got the demon on the other shoulder with the pitchfork jabbing at you. Right? Ooh, here come the rain. Here come the rain. Stormy day in Texas. So with the alcohol and the drug abuse, you know, not only are you doing the damage that they as chemicals do to you, you know, if somebody goes too far with the alcohol is going to get potentially like wet brain. That's brain damage, okay? We're not talking about psychological issues anymore. We're talking about a broken fucking organ, right? And then your liver, right? Long-term raging alcoholics and drug addicts alike end up with cirrhosis invariably, die of liver cancer, right? And then all kinds of other shit that can happen on the way. That's what happens just from ingesting the chemical too frequently for too long of a period, right? But anytime you do that, anytime you get wasted, you're into a life of high risk and misadventure. Drunk driving, right? You have a couple of beers. Hey, I'm all right. Just a little buzzed. You drive around. You think you're a little buzzed when you're completely fucking hammered. So you're at high risk now. Your odds of dying between when you turn the key and getting home or wherever the fuck you're going, it's 50-50 at best. Your life as a drug addict and alcoholic is 50-50. Every hour of every day, you are at a high risk of dying. High-risk lifestyle and misadventure, right? ODing, that's death by misadventure. You're having the adventure of your drug euphoria, and you just go a little too far with it, right? Misadventure, you're dead. Drunk driving, misadventure, you're dead. Drunk canoeing, right? I had a buddy, one buddy who was drunk on a canoe, went over a waterfall, conked his head, got trapped underwater, died, right? I had another buddy who was sober on a kayak on a river, got turned over and he died too, but he was sober. That was misadventure also, because it was a flood river, right? It was a raised up river in a flood situation. He shouldn't have been out there, but oh, he was a recovering person. He was no stranger to high risk and misadventure. These are abnormalcies threatening our own survival willingly, knowingly, intentionally, and at the same time romanticizing your death, having suicidal ideation. Abnormal, unnatural, with a cause that may or may not be known. Let me take it a step further here. We'll get into like sexual immorality, right? I'm going to take it from a perspective I could speak to with expertise, right? Looking at the heterosexual aspect of sexual immorality, I am a heterosexual, and I always have been, right? We still have unnatural sexual desire. Yes, I'm telling you that heterosexuality is natural, but within that nature, we are yet given over to immoral behavior. I look back at my own life. Okay, and I'm going to mention it again. I'm a heterosexual, and I always have been. And I have been from an early age, right? I was very early in life interested in girls. I could take it back to 4 or 5 years old for certain, right? For certain. And I recall my attitude, say between the ages of 4 and like 11 or 12, my attitude towards girls, right, was to find one and marry one and be with that one forever and ever. And that person was on a pedestal in my heart and in my mind right next to God. That's how I looked at sexuality as a child. Not that it was about sex, but that is what, that is the how do you say it? The mindscape, the room in my head where sex would eventually come into play, right? It was a, you know, it's a romantic relationship. Boy meets girl, gets married, right? And sex is a is part of all that. And the only time sex is moral is within those confines. So somehow in my nature, I knew that as a fucking five-year-old. I knew that monogamy was the way from the beginning. By nature. Which Romans 1 talks about. Somehow, some way, we have inherent to us knowledge of right and wrong. We have knowledge of God's law, right? The commandments. It's in us. We don't have to come from a background of religion. It's there. We have an inherent knowledge of it. We see it clearly when we look at the purple mountain's majesty over the fruited plain, right? It's that majesty of God. It's that awe and awesome that God is. Nature that is so big and so humongous, and it's nothing under the greatness of God. But it is absolute majesty to us. When we stand in those moments, we have an undeniable realization of the greatness of God. Oh, and our minds will fight it, but again, like letting knocking your conscience back with pills. That's pretty much what it requires, you know? Denial, 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 blotting it out of your head, using drugs to even accomplish that. To argue the obvious greatness, to the obvious good. And this is what I'm saying. As a five-year-old child, I already reckoned monogamy to be the way. And there was no other thought of no other thing. It wasn't a comparison. Well, I can have 15 wives or I can have this one. It never even occurred to me to have 15. What was natural was the one, right? Natural was the one. Monogamy from childhood. I just spoke to really what adultery is everything that's outside of the marriage. Anything sexual you do outside of marriage is adultery. Right? And here we now we start talking about things that are moral. We are talking about the Ten Commandments as the parameters for rightful living, right? And I know all this is a hard pill to swallow. Well, that's a Christian perspective, or I'm Christian, but I don't believe that to be true. Well, you know, we want to hold on to that which is immoral. That's part of our quote-unquote twisted nature, right? We don't have a nature to be evil, but it gets twisted up with this psychic invasion, this demonic invasion, this super unknown that crawls into our being and whispers sweet nothings into our ear. Yeah, we get twisted up and we become one with things that are immoral. And we live in a world that is full of people who do this, and therefore the world itself is always trying to tell you how okay, right? Quote unquote, okay. It's okay to do blank, and it's okay to do this other blank. This is normal to feel this way. It's normal to think that way. When it's not, it's not. I can remember one blessing I have is I can remember being very young. I got a block when it comes to this invasion that happened to me. But otherwise, I remember two ages that people don't generally, and then within those ages, more detail, right? Now, I have a very good memory as a young kid because the way my mind worked before I started taking drugs, right? I was just a very cerebral person. I can remember, like, you know, just thinking If I would, I'm looking at a stop sign. If I would say, okay, stop sign, there was a part of me that had to echo it back. Stop sign, stop sign, stop sign, stop sign, right? Everything I observed kind of had like slap back delay on it, right? And it just kind of drilled itself into my brain, you know? And that's, I think that's where so much memory comes from. My memory gets a little fuzzy once I start getting into narcotics and shit, you know, a little bit later. But anyway, all right, here's the point, right? Here's the whole point. What I'm calling unnatural behavior in the heterosexual sense is anything outside of the bonds of marriage. That's before you're married, that's after you're divorced, whatever, you know? You know, before you're with your next wife, if you are not properly married, recognized, married by God, because that is by definition what marriage is. Marriage is not just any old union. Marriage is God's binding of male and female, man and woman. It truly is. And y'all antichrist motherfuckers out there don't get that because you don't want to get that. But that's what it is. And it's a special union. And it's not just a commitment for the man to the woman and the woman to the man. It's also the woman to God over the marriage and the man to God over the marriage. And then God back to... It's a three-way union. That's what makes the marriage a marriage. If you don't have God in that, you don't have a marriage. You have some kind of legal license of union as a couple that is being... misappropriately called marriage, but it ain't. Sorry to tell you the basic facts of existence here, but that's the way it rolls. When you are in a proper marriage, then your sexuality is a proper thing. Otherwise, now you might get a little pass if you're married and just trying to do the right thing and you're not having sex with nobody else, including yourself. That's probably a little bit debatable, right? But in the strictest sense of it, a marriage involves God. It's His. My marriage with my wife right now is God's marriage. He owns the marriage. And remarkably, years go by. Not only have my wife and I never had an argument, we've never even had a disagreement. We are two peas in a pod. It is incredible. I've never had a relationship anywhere near as gratifying, as reliable and trustworthy, as soothing to my soul. She's a human sanctuary to me, who I completely trust and rely upon in every situation in any way. And I doubt very highly that many of you out there can say anything in the same light. Because in this world, to be married, the wife, the old ball and chain, the old battle axe, right? Ha ha ha, we laugh about being in a marriage and how fucking horrible it is. Well, that's not the way it's supposed to be. But it is. It's what we've become. And then when it sucks enough, what do? End it. Just fucking light it up on fire. Burn it down. Go get another one, right? And before you do that, you have an affair with somebody. You try them out for size and say, okay, you know, like Tarzan swinging from vine to vine. You don't let go of one until you got hold of the other, right? See, you destroy one marriage with this woman and then you go to marry her and make another marriage? I know for a fact. Yeah, God frowns on that, totally. That marriage made of the adultery that destroyed the previous marriage, forget about it. Forget about it. Anyhow, yes, of course, these things are a hard pill to swallow. This is all about living a life with God on God's terms, right? I speak frequently about God on God's terms. Normally when I bring that up, it's a matter of coming to faith in general. But once you've come to faith, God's terms don't stop. You live a life on his terms. And the terms are, as I described, where marriage is concerned, where sexuality is concerned. Just as I said, I am not wrong. I am not wrong. Take me as an extreme voice on this matter, and constantly for the rest of your life, compare whatever the fuck it is you're doing to the standard I'm setting. And see how your conscience works. See how much fucking pills you have to take to get through the day. I know, that's kind of mean, I'm sorry. But I'm not done. Hard pill to swallow. Knuckle fuckery, right? I love that word. It's just so funny to me. That's in my dictionary. That's a Maverick 88, by the way. The knuckle fuckery. You know what knuckle fuckery is. Just think about it. You're fucking your knuckles. What does that mean to say? Figure it out for yourself. That shit never, ever stands. That shit, first and foremost, is queer. It's gay. And we're going to talk about homosexuality very soon, right? But it is that. It's vain. It is outside the bounds of your marriage. It's depraved. It incorporates, invokes pornography, which is further semblance of sin, which in its own way has its own addictive course, right? Just like when you get hooked on alcohol and cocaine and heroin, how it starts so sweet and ends so jagged and mean and cruel. Leaves you in dark and bitter places. Pornography has that same race with you. It makes you jaded. It makes normal sexual relations not satisfying enough. And it's all in your fucking head. Your head is all twisted and distorted. Because up there is where your devils live. And they're speaking to you all the time. Fucking you up and fucking you up and fucking you up. And what ends up happening? Well, you go from being satisfied with your wife to what? Not being so satisfied, trying different things, this and that, incorporating all kinds of toys and weird shit, ultimately just cheating on her outright, you know? And the more jaded that you get, the more it takes to, quote, get you off. So you start exploring all kinds of alternative options. And you end up in same-sex situations. You end up in with animals and children. Other inanimate objects, whatever. All kinds of shit. But it just gets more and more, here's a word for you, depraved, right? More and more depraved. Sex outside of marriage. If you just keep that, the bounds of it together, avoid the pornography, avoid and subsequently avoid the knuckle fuckery, you will have substantial, significant, adequate sexuality with the right person in the right situation. And then with that person, you will have peace and trust. What the fuck else do you really want, you know? But see, we lose our nature. Our nature gets twisted and warped. But these parameters I'm talking about, these relationships, the morality, it's all biblical stuff, right? So that's what I say. You take the opinions that I'm offering to you, regard them as standards that I'm setting, and recognize that those are biblical moral standards. You could call them Christian moral standards, but that's the only morality there really is. Everything else is ethics, right? But whatever. However you want to define it, these are standards. These are Maverick 88 standards that he believes are given by God. So you compare your stuff to it and see where you're wanting. That pissed off some people. I pissed off some people. But you got to look at me, man. Look at me. Look how fucked up I was. Do you think I'm speaking from a place? Do you think I've gone all my life without making these mistakes? Adultery and all every fucking thing that I've just been talking about. Do you think I've gone my whole life? No, I came to my senses somewhere in my adulthood. I came to God on God's terms. I stuck with it. And in sticking with it, I found that he had more terms. And the more I abided by the terms that he laid down before me, the better my shit got. It's simple. It's easy math. Wasn't easy to accomplish. A lot of changes had to happen. And that's the point. Once I was one way and now I'm another. So what I'm pointing at right here, I'm pointing at immorality and failures, basic moral failures of people in general. As you're listening to it, you're looking at yourself and saying, oh my God, right? But realize, as I speak these things, I'm speaking not just to you, but a person in my past, the man I was. I know what I'm talking about. I know the difference. I have gone through it, and I have seen the results. Now, as we address this topic of morality, right? Morality, and I talk about nature, right? Or I'm talking about unnatural behavior, so the flip side of that is natural. You know, what is natural, what is quote-unquote normal? The thing about morality, the thing about God's way, right? God's terms, the parameters that He sets for us to live within seems to have a way of adding up to taking that which is natural under creation, right? God's creation, which is natural, which is the nature, and keeping everything natural. We're not abiding by God and finding ourselves twisting nature. And I think about, you know, the irony of the world now compared to how it was 50 years ago. You had the hippies, right? They love Mother Nature and the environment, and they admired the Native Americans, the Plains Indians, how they lived, and they wanted to live communal lifestyles in harmony with nature. And at the same time, they were pacifists, and they hated the war, and they were anti-war. Those were your leftists of the day in the late 60s, right? In the early 70s, the Vietnam era, the hippies and all that. But now your leftists are the opposite. They're the fucking opposite. They're not anti-war. They're the ones that, quote-unquote, stand with Ukraine. They're all about the war. World War III on the brink. They're all about that. Blow the fucking place to bits. Suicidal ideation, right? The hatred of humanity and mankind in general. The hatred of God and creation. And also, yeah, here we go. Hatred of God and creation. Now it's a hatred of nature. Everything's got a chemical answer to it. Everything has got a mechanical answer to it. Everything has got a digital answer to it. Everything is science. Trust the fucking science, right? What was once a hippie and had beliefs in the 60s is now whatever the fuck it is, and it believes completely the opposite. But it's still leftist. Incredible, right?
The Down Comes series continues in the next release of Post-Harlan Monologics.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Harlan Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Harlan Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postharlan.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postharlan.com.